This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Supernatural Mom Show. I'm your host, Beth Greer, and I'm here to bring you information you need to know to keep you and your family happy and healthy. Thank you so much for listening today. Well, if you've ever asked yourself, why did I get sick? Why is the cancer rate so high? Why is my child born with birth defects or learning disabilities? You'll want to hear what my first guest, Dr. Janet Sherman, has to say. Dr. Sherman is a physician, activist, mom, and the author of Life's Delicate Balance, Causes and Prevention of Breast Cancer. Dr. Sherman says that the same things that cause breast cancer also cause cancers and other health problems in men and children. And then, if your child is having a tough time at bedtime or is having difficulty with schoolwork or with friends or has fears or headaches or other physical ailments or even has a tough time loving and accepting him or herself, you want to hear my second guest, Dr. Charlotte Resnick. She has an innovative way to teach your children how to overcome these common childhood stressors. Dr. Resnick is a child educational psychologist and associate clinical professor of psychology at UCLA. And she's got an amazing approach to helping kids and adolescents heal themselves from stress and anxiety. So stick around and hear what she has to say in the second half of the show. But first, I'm very excited about a new show I'll be hosting called The Supernatural Teen Show right here on PRN. It premieres this Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and my two co-hosts are here now to talk a little bit about the show. These two young women are amazing teens. Erin Schroeder is 18, and she has been called the face of the new green generation. She's a founding member and spokeswoman for the Teens Turning Green campaign. And Erin recently helped launch lines of the Teens Turning Green collection of green skin and body care with Whole Foods Market nationwide. And this fall, she began her studies in international relations as a presidential honors scholar at New York University. Hi, Erin. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. And I also want to introduce Maddie Kahn. She's 17, and she's the co-president of the New York chapter of Teens Turning Green and on the National Advisory Board for the campaign. And Maddie writes the natural makeup and beauty column for the newly launched online magazine, BeautyBlitz.com. And both girls are working on the Teens for Healthy Schools initiative. So our first show is going to be about why it's so important for girls and women to use safe cosmetics. So why don't you, each of you take a couple of minutes and talk about some of the issues we'll be covering this Sunday.
Yeah, thank you so much, Beth. I'm so excited. We're happy to be on PRN with the new show.
Great.
Premiering this Sunday, but safe cosmetics really was my entryway into the deeper shades of green, as I like to call it, into the depths of really all that a green lifestyle can be. And we're not aware of the hundreds of chemicals, synthetics, that are going on to our body with the dozens of products we use from morning till night. And I think it's really wonderful to be able to show people how fantastic the green alternatives are out there and the studies that have been done by the likes of the National Campaign for Safe Cosmetics Environmental Working Group that link what we use on our bodies to cancer, birth defects, and reproductive harm. And frankly, especially when I'm in puberty and throughout my life when I'm setting up my purchasing habits, it's not something I want anywhere near my body.
Right. And Maddie,
yeah.
are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I just think, you know, like Erin said, it's such an important aspect, especially of a teen's life, you know, what you're putting on your face, what you're putting on your body. And I think that even though there's some resistance from the bigger cosmetics and makeup and skincare companies, there's been a lot more acceptance of the importance of what a green lifestyle, a fully green lifestyle, incorporating organic and natural products into your daily routine and replacing the ones that are definitely just more toxic, more chemical-laden, with the alternatives, something that's just really come into its own recently, and it's so exciting to be a part of it. And I think, you know, the products are prettier, they work better, and natural has become increasingly easy to find and to use. And it's a pleasure to talk about it. And we're really excited for Sunday and to talk about it at length.
Great. Yeah, you girls are such an inspiration. And so we're encouraging all of your friends and people that you know to call in and ask questions. And let's see, anything else that you want to add that we're going to be covering on Sunday? This Sunday will be about Safe Cosmetics, and then each week we're going to have a different topic.
I think I would really encourage anyone who has any questions, definitely call in between Erin and myself and you. There's a plenty of advice and recommendations to pass along. So if anyone out there has any questions, they should definitely call in on Sunday. We'd love to hear from them.
Okay,
that's
great.
Your body. So we're here, and we'll be here for weeks to come talking about anything you want to learn about green and young people. And it's just a joy to be a part of it.
Great. And the number to call for people is 888-873-4643.
Okay, thank you so much, Beth. I'm running off to class now.
Yes, okay, great. Thanks, girls.
Bye.
Bye. Talk Sunday. Okay, well, I wanted to read a little bit about what's going on in the news before I bring up my first guest. And if you've ever needed an excuse to drink chocolate with your milk, here it is. According to the New York Times, a recent study showed that regularly consuming flavonoid-rich cocoa can reduce inflammation. And cocoa has been proven to slow down the development of atherosclerosis and inflammation of the arteries and potentially prevent it from developing in the first place. Along with reducing inflammation, cocoa can also raise the levels of good cholesterol in the body. Just by taking cocoa twice a day for about a month, you can improve the quality of your health. But this doesn't mean you should run to your nearest store and buy any old sweet milk chocolate. The chocolate that the study is talking about contains high levels of dark cocoa. They're not talking Yoo-hoo here. So go for the organic dark chocolate if you can. Let's see. There's a question that's come up. Are store-bought soils safe for growing vegetables? Well, back in September, Los Angeles Times reporter Susan Carpenter found high levels of lead in the chard she'd been growing in her backyard planter box, which was filled with store-bought soil. And the head of the lab that tested her chard told Susan that it's not advisable to eat more than a quarter pound of the leaves a day or she'd risk lead poisoning. Susan decided to test her potting soil, and she went to three stores and bought six popular brands of bagged soil labeled for fruits and vegetables: Miracle-Gro, Supersoil, Earth-Gro, Kellogg, Sunland, and E.B. Stone, and sent samples of each to two different labs. The findings, well, none of the soils contained toxic levels of lead, zinc, or arsenic, but there were heavy metals in every bag soil, although they were at pretty low levels. But the test didn't explain the high lead level in her chard. One possible culprit, she reasoned, could be the fish fertilizer she used every couple of weeks. What I took away from this was that the bag soil is probably pretty safe, although I would go with an organic version to be even safer. And the other thing I found interesting in this article is that if you're composting, there's a chance that your compost ingredients could be high in toxics, especially if you're using newspaper, because of the inks. And I just read something about soy ink using pretty nasty chemicals to make the ink, and then if we're composting that, it's getting into our fruits and vegetables, so something to be aware of. Let's see, a new study found that school drinking water seems to be tainted. According to the Charleston Daily Mail, unsafe levels of lead, pesticides, and dozens of other harmful toxins have been found in school drinking water across the nation. Several public and private schools in all 50 states have violated the Safe Drinking Water Act. Schools that use wells as their main water source are at a higher risk of having contaminated drinking water. In the last decade, the amount of water safety violations has multiplied, and little has been done to fix this unacceptable issue. Schools in older buildings where high levels of lead are likely to concentrate in old metal pipes have also reported unsafe drinking water. These schools usually get their drinking water from local utilities, and they're not required to test for toxins. There was a survey conducted in 2006 which found that almost half of the nation's schools did not test their water for lead.
A lead is known to retard the learning abilities of children as well as damage major organs. There have been a number of cases where children have suffered severe stomach aches, nausea, exhaustion, and disorientation after drinking water at school. So what can parents do to make sure their children are safe? Ask if your school's drinking water has been tested for toxins. And a lot of schools have purchased water coolers in every classroom, while others are fixing the problem by buying bottled water for their students. Well, an even better option is for you to get a water filter at home and send your child to school with a metal water bottle. And please stay away from plastics because it can leach chemicals. The EPA has done a study, and it found that there are toxic chemicals in freshwater fish, and it's pretty widespread. Let's see. Did you know that almost half of the lakes and reservoirs in the U.S. contain fish with harmful levels of mercury? According to a study conducted by the Environmental Protection Agency, the levels of mercury present are way higher than what the EPA considers safe for people to eat. Eating fish with harmful levels of mercury can damage the nervous system and cause learning disabilities for a fetus or a young child. So how did the mercury get into our fish? Well, mercury is frequently released from power plants and that burn coal, and these fumes are then expelled into the air. The EPA says that this study once again confirms that we have to figure out a way to reduce, if not eliminate, mercury from our waters, as well as provide information to people who eat fish regularly so that we know about this health-threatening phenomenon. And with big industries involved, this matter has already been swept under the rug. Earlier this year, the Obama administration said it would begin developing new regulations to control mercury emissions, but the federal appeals court has since thrown out those plans. So we need to protect ourselves and our families. One really good website to check out is oceansalive.org, and I have more tips on choosing safe seafood in my book, Supernatural Home. Now, also, my first guest, who's here, will be addressing power plants and toxins in our air and water. She's Janet Sherman, MD, a physician, an activist, mom, and the author of the book Life's Delicate Balance, Causes and Prevention of Breast Cancer, as well as Chemical Exposure and Disease is her other book. Dr. Sherman is a specialist in internal medicine and toxicology. She has published more than 70 articles in the scientific literature and also writes for the popular press. Dr. Sherman worked in radiation and biological research at the University of California Nuclear Facility and at the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory at Hunters Point in San Francisco. From 76 to 82, Dr. Sherman served on the advisory board for the EPA Toxic Substances Control Act. She's been an advisor to the National Cancer Institute on breast cancer and to the EPA on pesticides. She's also an advisor and a speaker for universities and health advocacy groups concerning cancer, birth defects, pesticide, toxic dump sites, and nuclear radiation. And Dr. Sherman has also served as a medical legal expert witness for thousands of individuals harmed by exposure to toxic agents. Currently, she's adjunct professor at the Environmental Institute, Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and she's research associate and lecturer with the Radiation and Public Health Project. Long intro. Welcome to the Supernatural Mom Show, Dr. Sherman.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Great. Now, you say in your book that traditional risk factors, including genetics, account for no more than 30% of breast cancers. So how do we explain the causes of the other 70%? What's going on?
Well, actually, the genetic factors are probably between 5 and 10%, not even 30. Mm-hmm. And the traditional, you know, what is causing breast cancer is our environment, the PCBs, the polychlorinated biphenyls, the pesticides, X-ray exposure to X-ray in mammography, and emissions from nuclear power plants, as well as the estrogenic substances, excuse me, that we've been reading about a great deal lately. You know, the plasticizers that are in the lining of food cans and plastic food, paper food cartons. So there is many, many exposures going on right now that are cumulative and resulting in higher breast cancer, but also higher prostatic cancer and cancer in throughout the population.
You know, there was just a report that was released on Monday by the International Journal of Health Services that says that this thyroid cancer epidemic in New York counties that are surrounding the Indian Point nuclear power plant, and they're the highest in New York State and among the highest in the U.S., like 66% above average.
Yes.
So, I mean, that speaks right to the effect of this radiation in the air. So can you talk a little bit about how we're exposed to radiation, even if we're not living by a nuclear power plant?
Well, that's the study that was done by Joe Mangano from the Radiation and Public Health Group. He found that there was a very high rate of thyroid cancer around the Indian Point reactor, but also he found that the highest thyroid cancer rates for men, women, blacks, and whites was in the eastern part of Pennsylvania and New Jersey and leading up toward New York State. And all of those areas are downwind from major nuclear power plants. Well, each nuclear power plant, as it's running, gives off many isotopes. These are released into the air. They don't tell you this, but these data are available on the Internet and can be researched. As these radioisotopes fall to the ground with rain and snow, they're deposited on plants, and then they are, you know, eaten by, particularly by dairy animals, taken up by these animals and excreted in their milk. Therefore, if you are drinking milk or eating dairy products that come from areas around, say, eastern Pennsylvania, which is a big dairying area, northern Maryland, then you are getting exposed to these isotopes that are released from the nuclear power plants. And these include such things as strontium-90, cesium-137, and the shorter-lived but still present iodine isotopes that are taken up by the thyroid gland.
That's really interesting, you know, because even if you're not just living in eastern Pennsylvania, let's say the dairies there are exporting their milk to larger companies like Kraft or whatever, and they're making cheeses and other products that we're all eating.
Well, it's interesting because after Chernobyl, there was a very high rate of thyroid disease in Washington, D.C. Now, to my understanding, I don't think there's a dairy herd anywhere in Washington, D.C.
Right.
But they get their milk from, you know, Maryland and state of Pennsylvania, and it's imported into like Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. Beg your pardon, Washington D.C. All these cities where there are no dairy herds, but they're getting their milk from the farms that are, you know, receiving the fallout from the nuclear power plants.
And you know, it also makes me think that even if it's organic milk, it wouldn't matter. If they're grazing on grass, let's say, or pasture, and if they're getting the fallout, they're still eating this stuff that's coming through into the milk.
You're absolutely correct, and that's one of the big problems. Many of us buy organic milk for ourselves and our families, and we think, well, we're doing a good thing. And in some ways, yes, it's a big help because those are the dairies that are not using hormones with their animals, and we hope they're not using pesticides and things like that. But even if it's an organic dairy, but if it's downwind from a nuclear power plant, it's still receiving the radiation from these nuclear power plants.
So your opinion about nuclear power then what's the answer? Just shut them all down? I mean, it seems like our government is not going to do that, right?
Well, the government won't do anything unless we, the citizens, you know, force it to. I mean, how long did it take for women to get the vote and for blacks to get the votes? I mean, it required citizens to demand it. But there is a big push, and it's coming largely from French corporations, to build more nuclear power plants. I'm convinced that we absolutely cannot and the ones that are existing really must be shut down. Some of the work that we've done has shown that childhood cancer rates decreased in a number of counties downwind from nuclear power plants when the power plants were closed, and childhood health improved in these counties that when after these nuclear power plants were closed.
Has there been research done in France, let's say, or in Europe of counties and their incidence of cancer that are surrounding nuclear power plants?
Yes, there's been very recently a number of studies came out of Germany showing a higher rate of leukemia in children who live in proximity to nuclear power plants. Much of this information is available at a website called www.radiation.org, and the articles are actually there and available to the public.
That's really interesting. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the new guidelines, you know, the government task force guidelines on getting mammograms now after 50, and also if you think that the radiation from this procedure was doing more harm than good, and do you think that's one of the reasons they're suggesting that women, younger women, not get so many mammograms?
Well, I hope that's one of the reasons that they have, you know, suggested fewer mammograms, because every exposure to X-ray, whether it's dental or mammography or a CT scan, increases your chance of getting cancer. So you want to minimize your exposure to radiation, which includes X-ray, as well as fallout from nuclear power plants. I don't know if this has something to do with the insurance industry trying to save money. I really don't know one way or another. One of the things that I thoroughly disagree with on the newest suggestions is to close out self-examination. Many, many patients that I have seen were the ones who found their own lumps. And we have to remember that I would say that every man that I ever saw, every man patient that I ever saw diagnosed with testicular cancer, believe me, found it himself by self-examination.
Now, it seems crazy for them to say to stop doing self-exams. It's just nuts. I mean,
well, but it has to be done correctly. And one of the experts in the world on that is a woman by the name of Dr. Rosalie Bertel, originally from Canada, who is not only a PhD and an expert in nuclear radiation issues, but she also happens to be a nun. So I think her word is pretty, you know, cannot be questioned. But we and a number of us maintain that women who are trained to do self-examination, and these can also be nurse practitioners, these don't have to be physicians, need to teach women that they should check their breasts after their menses. This is for women who are still having menstrual periods, after their menstrual periods. For women who are older, they should just mark a date on the calendar and check once a month to see if there's any change in the texture of their breasts. This is pretty simple, and it's pretty cost-effective. And I really disagree that when they say we don't want to continue doing breast exams. Well, they don't have to be done by physicians.
Right, okay. You know, I was also horrified to read a report recently about teenage girls and tweens, you know, even like 10, 11-year-old girls are getting breast cancer. And that's kind of a new thing.
Well, it is. Young girls are getting breast cancer, but there's a little epidemiological exercise that any of us can do, is go to a shopping mall and sit down and look at the first 20, 25 young girls who walk by, or the first 20 or 25 young boys who walk by. The boys are developing breasts at a very young age. This did not occur 50 years ago, believe me. And young girls, 11, 12, 13-year-old, are developing large breasts and having the onset of their periods at ages 10, 11, 12, very, very young. Now, this has to reflect estrogenic effects in their environment, either in their food or in the plastics that contain their food or the plastics that are in the environment. So this is a big change over the last 50 years.
So that's one of the things I tell people all the time, is to get rid of the plastic They don't realize that, you know, it's so ubiquitous and it's easy to get rid of, even, you know, in the food containers that we store our leftovers in, to our drinking bottles. Just start replacing them with glass or metal. And
You're absolutely correct. Absolutely. I have a collection of small, medium, and quart jars that I have been storing my food in for years. And one of the other things that your listeners, I hope, know is never, never microwave anything in plastic.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about bioidentical hormones in menopausal women. It seems to be, you know, in the news a lot. There's a lot of controversy around it. And I'm curious to know what you think, what your opinion is about that.
You mean taking hormones for postmenopausal?
Yes.
Oh, I think it's crazy. I mean, menopause is a natural phenomenon that's been going on for centuries. And this whole hype that came out in the 50s and 60s that it'll make you keep you younger, it's better for your skin, it'll prevent, you know, Alzheimer's, absolutely none of that was shown to be true. And indeed what we've found is these postmenopausal hormones are resulting in increased breast cancer. In fact, if you read the product data sheet on a number of the products that were sold, they said that after 5 years, your increased chances of breast cancer was increased.
Mm-hmm. Right. I know what some women that I know are going, every 3 months, and all just getting scanned because they're taking the hormones, but then they were told by their doctor that they have a higher risk. It just seems a little crazy to, you know.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, if they're taking the hormones, then they're increasing their risk. A, and B, and if they're getting more mammograms, then they're really increasing their risk.
Mm.
Now, there are other techniques besides mammography that have been used elsewhere than in the United States, and they've been excellent. Thermography,
right,
which measures the heat output of the breast, and it's a physiological test rather than an anatomic one, which is like X-ray mammography. And then there's also ultrasound, which is very good for finding abnormalities in the breast.
Mm-hmm. I've been reading a lot about the Pink Ribbon campaign and how these corporations, particularly makeup companies, will donate all this money to research, and yet their products contain carcinogenic ingredients that women are putting on their skin. So I'm sure, I mean, you agree with me about that. I know I read a little bit about that in your book, and I'm wondering, which breast cancer advocacy groups do you like?
Well, the one in San Francisco run by Barbara Brenner, I think, is very, very sound, and they have had quite a large campaign, the saying, think before you pink, which I think is valid. And I would recommend to women, you know, that our worth is not dependent upon our use of cosmetics. I mean, I think that there are cosmetic products that are, you know, less toxic, and we should stay away from as much as we possibly can.
Right. The name of that group is Breast Cancer Action, I believe.
That's the one, yes, yeah. And they're very good.
Great. Any others that you like that you think are worth supporting?
Well, I have not. They're the one group that I think have done the very best job.
Mm-hmm.
I also have been involved with the Canadian group, the Breast Cancer Action in Canada, and there's a very, very active group in Montreal that has done a superb job working with Canadian women.
Okay, and you know, you say that the war on cancer will not be won until we focus on prevention. So what do you suggest we do aside from eating, you know, organic food, and that's not always the answer, or drinking purified water? What are some of the things that we can do?
Well, I think that much of this is driven by economics and politics. And if we mobilize our activities and say we do not want nuclear power plants and we want the ones that are operating to be closed, I think this is a very important thing for people to do. But also we need to clean up dump sites and, you know, toxic sites that are filled with PCBs and pesticides and other toxic chemicals. And obviously, I think one of the best things we can do is stop using what I call beauty herbicides and pesticides on our lawns and in our, you know, on our properties, because this is, you know, just not, absolutely not needed. Nobody ever died from a dandelion.
Right. And I think it's also, you know, you write in your book about Mobile, for example, and these other corporations who are donating money to fund research. And so I think it's really important for people to become aware of who's actually doing the funding.
Oh, you're absolutely correct, yes. You know, who's behind these organizations? And what do they really do? One of the biggest backers of the Pink Ribbon campaign is ICI AstraZeneca, that makes tamoxifen. But they also make a number of industrial chemicals, herbicides, and pesticides.
Yeah, it's really ironic and sad at the same time. They give the impression that they're helping because they have a drug that helps you once you get cancer, but they're not really helping in preventing it at all.
Well, that's right. I mean, but they can't lose, because if they wind up making a drug to treat cancer, that they also make products that cause cancer. So they're economically, they're doing very well.
Right. Now, your book, I think everyone should read your book, and I know it's out of print, so how can they order it?
No, it's not. Well,
Out of print. Okay.
It's not out. My publisher took it out of print when it was selling extremely well. And I have the remaining copies, and they are available at www.janet, spelled J-A-N-E-T-T-E, Sherman, S-H-E-R-M-A-N.com. And
great.
Or you can contact me by my email, which is toxdoc, toxdoc@verizon.net. And I have the books. I've cut the price from $25 to $10.
Great. It's very well researched and
thank you.
Very eye-opening, and you know, I think there are things in here that people will be surprised. And
let's hope that it can help somebody prevent cancer in their family.
Yeah. And what's your opinion about DCI, for example? Like, so many women, you know, if they get a diagnosis of that in terms of breast cancer, they think it's like sort of a death sentence, and they go to get surgery and radiation, chemo. And do you think that, you know, what's your opinion about what women should do in that situation?
Well, I think I would certainly not go with the radiation and the chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. Now, depending on how widespread it is and whether it's both breasts, sometimes surgery is the answer. But I think one has to know a little bit more about how many sites are involved and whether it's both breasts.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time today, and good luck with your work and spreading the word and getting your important information out to people.
Well, and then thanks to you for the work you're doing to educate people. I think it's very important what you're doing.
Great. Thank you. We've been talking to Janet Sherman, MD. And please check out her book, Life's Delicate Balance. And now my second guest is here, and she's Dr. Charlotte Resnick. She's an internationally recognized child education psychologist and associate clinical professor of psychology at UCLA. And she's got an amazing therapeutic approach to help children and adolescents heal themselves of stress, anxiety, sleep issues, self-esteem issues, all through the use of imagery. She's the author of The Power of Your Child's Imagination, How to Transform Stress and Anxiety into Joy and Success. And I've been using the techniques in her book very successfully with my own daughter. Welcome to the Supernatural Mom Show, Charlotte. Great. Your book is amazing. You know, I used to run the Learning Annex and have been taking personal transformation seminars and workshops for over 25 years. And I took classes from people like Shakti Gawain and Tony Robbins. And I tried to teach my daughter the things that I learned, but she's been very resistant up until your book came along. She's totally excited about imagery now. And it was like a light bulb went off in her head, and she started drawing pictures of her inner world. And I just wanted to thank you so much.
I'm so happy to hear this. How old is she?
She's 12.
Perfect.
She's 12. But something just clicked for her, and and she not only is she drawing, she's actually knitting her inner wizard, and she's turning it into a doll.
Ah,
it's fantastic.
Great.
Yeah, so
oh,
I'm sure that this is what you're looking for, you know, when a parent reads your book. I mean, this is what you want to happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so thrilled. I am.
Right. So what does research say about the power of a child's imagination, or all of our, not just children, adults as well, right?
Yes, the research started with adults in using visualization, imagination, imagery, back with Carl Symington, relating to your previous guest about cancer, because he used imagery with cancer. And then in the last 10, 15 years or so, there's been more funding with children and more in the health field, because that's where funding comes from. And so it's really been shown with many areas of health. Asthma, you can reduce medication or get off of asthma. Chronic stomach pain, there's just been a recent study that's been out from Duke University and University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, a very simple study where they used imagery, imagination techniques with kids and made some CDs for them. And the kids that used the CDs had a third, like reduced their pain three times as much as the kids that didn't listen.
That's fantastic.
It's just great. So every time I hear about another little study coming out, I get very excited because I see this all the time in my clinical practice, as well as for headaches and migraines and tics and a lot of research in those areas. And, of course, we know about all the sports imagery and imagination techniques. That's across the board. I mean, I remember when I was writing, Michael Phelps had won that 8 gold medals, and he said when everyone thought it couldn't be done, all it took was a little imagination. So there's a lot of backup for this over the years.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the 9 tools that you write about in your book?
Sure, because I wanted to go beyond traditional guided imagery, although I do that for kids, and I do have CDs like that. But I wanted to find simple, quick tools that kids could access their own wisdom very quick, you know, right away. So the first one, which has been around a long time, but I call it the balloon breath because it's an easy visual. And you kind of imagine there's a balloon about 2 to 3 inches below your belly button. And when you breathe in, you want the balloon to blow up. And when you breathe out, you want it to flatten. Because a lot of times when kids and adults, too, when you ask them to breathe in, they, like, suck in their belly.
Right, and they breathe relaxing. From their upper chest.
Right, right. Yeah. So physiologically, when you breathe down 2 to 3 inches below your belly button, that will relax you and calm you. It lowers blood pressure. It does all kinds of good things. But more importantly, to me, it's the first step to calm yourself and go inside and do your inner work. And you could respond rather than react to things. And it's good for parents as well as kids. So I like to teach both parents and kids together. And then they practice together. And you want to practice when you don't need it, just like when you're practicing for a sport. You want to be able to use it easily when you need it, when you're upset, but you got to practice. So I usually start out with 3 breaths. And then they work up to a minute because, you know, everyone complains there's no time, but everyone can find a minute. So then I'll time kids even, see how few breaths they could do in a minute. And so that's the first step. Then you want to have a little respite from the stresses of life. So I have them discover a special place that they can relax, they could regroup, they could just get away from life stress for a little while. But it's also a really good place to continue to do their inner work and get answers. And so this special place could be outside, inside. I kind of tell kids, you know, it's fine to space out. We'll just do it in a healthy way because kids are daydreaming anyway. Might as well use it to their advantage.
Right.
And I do have one caveat that you could include anyone you want or any animals, but once they step through your door, they have to love and accept you just the way you are because I want to avoid it becoming a not such a special nice place. And this way, if you have fights with your brother or sister or having an argument with one of your parents, you could put that aside.
That's
when you
really great.
Them.
My daughter's special place was filled with puppies, so that was really sweet.
That's great. Did she find a gift that reminded her how unique she was?
She did. Well, her inner wizard gave her a gift, and she didn't understand it. And then I saw in your book that if your child doesn't understand it, tell her to ask the wizard what it means. So I did. I just followed your script. It was brilliant, right? And she said that the wizard gave her a yellow flashlight with a compass on it so that whenever she'd had any questions on what to do, she would shine it and she'd know what direction to go in.
Oh, I love that. I got the chills.
I know.
Great. So you're bringing up the wizard because he's one of the inner guides. So we want the kids to access information. And if you just ask a child a direct question, they'll often say, I don't know. But if they have an animal friend or a wizard, it kind of bypasses their defense system and it kind of taps into something they really like, and it's fun. So I have kids imagine a loving animal friend, a protector who has their best interests at heart, and a wizard sort of the master teacher in human form. And so sometimes you need a little extra magic. And with Harry Potter so popular these last several years, wizards are all the rage. And animals could be, they could be very strong and powerful. Like one boy was going for some medical test, and he was really scared, so he imagined a pride of lions around the door.
Mm.
Or another girl was really afraid of going to sleep at night. She was afraid somebody was going to break in. And even though they had an alarm system, she still had fear. So she imagined a big white dragon that she called Valcor that wrapped around her bed and kept her safe. And she also put a tiger at the door just to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helped her. And when she started worrying about her parents and her brother, she just sent in Valcor's friends and relatives to help them. So that made her feel safe also. And what I thought was very, very brilliant for a young girl, she said, you know, my fears come from my imagination, so I have to go into the imaginary realm to solve them.
Hmm.
So I thought that was really insightful because it was a way of thinking, well, you know, it's just your imagination, it's not real, but she realized that her fears, you know, because she really was safe, we're coming from this other place as well. So it makes perfect sense to me that she mm-hmm. has to pull in from that you know, mystical, mythical realm. And
really
then the wizard, does your girl have an all-purpose wizard or does she have mini wizards?
Oh, she gave the details of the costume. You know, he had a hat on with a little a ruby hanging from the end of it. I have to go into, you know, find out more about this. It was so explicit. And then she, you know, this morning, sometimes I'll ask her a question and she doesn't have an answer. So I said to her, well, what does your wizard say? I said, go in, take your balloon breath and check in with your wizard. And he had an answer for her. So I just think this is like such a useful tool.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's great. That's what I'm hoping to do. Arm kids with all the tools they need, or as many tools they need, to meet whatever challenges they face. And you did it perfectly. When she didn't know, she asked her wizard. And so once she harnesses all her, you know, her heart and her belly have answers, her animal friends have answers, and so she could just have a problem and close her eyes, focus on her balloon breathing, and see who shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Does an animal show up? Could be a different animal each time. Does a wizard show up? Does her heart, does that become bright and wants to speak to her? So once the kids have all these nine tools, they could use whatever is appropriate for the situation at hand.
Right. And the other great thing I just wanted to share was that she wanted me to do it too. She wanted me to sit down and draw with her. So it forced me to actually reconnect, because I do have my own power animal, but what I noticed that was that my animal changed, I think, because I hadn't touched in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was interesting, and it had a new message for me, and it had a gift for me. So I was I'm just very grateful.
I'm touched. I'm really happy. Last night I just spoke to a group of parents at a school in Santa Monica, and so I led them through their own imageries because it really helps to know what your kids are going to go through as you go through it. And as you know, there's a chapter on grown-ups need tools too.
Right.
So it's wonderful to use it for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really great.
I'm so excited.
Great. So, you know, sleeping, falling asleep for kids, it can be a challenge very often. So can you kind of tell some parents who are listening how they might use some of your tools to get their kids to fall asleep?
I think that's a great idea because, like this little girl who used Valcor when she was afraid, sometimes kids' minds just go rampant and they can't stop thinking about tomorrow, or they can't stop worrying, or, you know, it could be good things, could be bad things, but they just can't turn their mind off. So when they focus on something relaxing to them, or they ask for help from one of their animal friends or wizards, then they could get there. They can get things that could help them. For example, one girl was having, you know, a really hard time falling asleep, and she called in an animal friend, and a unicorn showed up. Mm-hmm. I think it was Miss Sapphire, although in the book I might have called her Miss Emerald. And she gave her a sleeping powder in a beautiful perfume jar that she would sprinkle on her head and say to herself, falling asleep. So by doing that, she put herself in that almost self-hypnotic trance where she was able to relax her body and go to sleep. And she felt very proud of herself because she could do it. So the answers are within the child. All you have to do is help them find a way.
Right. Yeah, it's funny because I said to my daughter, well, you know, you could ask your wizard for help with your math. And she said, well, he's not going to give me the answers, but he's going to tell me how to do it.
Great.
So,
that's great. So yeah. She immediately kept using it. One boy I was working with had terrible time with spelling, and he got like 27 or 28 words wrong in one dictation paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And so he called in a spelling wizard. That's what I was asking you. Some wizards are all-purpose, and sometimes you need specific ones. So his spelling wizard would kind of clean out his brain so he could really learn better, and the information would go in, and all his worries would disappear. And then he'd kind of imagine doing flashcards with him, and then he would whisper the correct spelling in his ear. And so after a few months, his errors went down to 3 or 4.
Mm.
That was such an improvement for him.
That's great.
It did is it helped calm him. He didn't have to panic, and he was therefore able to learn better.
Now, Charlotte, do you think that we're actually tapping into something else, some bigger field of information out there when we do this?
It's very possible, because there is, in Jungian terms, there's a collective unconscious that we all can tap into. Even dreams are set up like that. We can have personal dreams, and we can have collective dreams. And so that's very possible.
Interesting.
I mean, it just depends what people believe, because I could talk about this work as being very cognitive behavioral, and on the other hand, there's also a spiritual component. I mean, one time I was taking the kids to a different planet with the idea that this planet was more idealized than Earth, and they were going to bring back 3 gifts to bring to Earth to make Earth, you know, better. And one girl went out, and she said she saw God. So everyone has their own belief system, and I just go wherever the child goes.
Right. Yeah, that's good. So what about, like, a child who's suffering from feeling bad about himself or is being bullied? What can you do for someone like that? How can they help
themselves?
That
happens all the time, more and more.
Right.
Both young kids and old kids. I mean, I'm thinking of a little girl who, you know, it seemed to her that her friends were ignoring her and didn't want to eat lunch with her. So she actually asked for help, and a crystal wizard, a young wizard, showed up and gave her these gifts. One was a star crystal that made her feel like a star no matter what, and one was a heart crystal to help her love herself and be open to liking her friends. And what that did was it gave her more confidence about herself. So the next day when she went back to school, she was able to just go up to the kids like nothing happened, and they were open to her, and she might have imagined they were ignoring her, or they might really have been ignoring her, but because she had the confidence and felt better about herself, it worked out much, you know, much better. And then when you get older, you know, with teens, it can be miserable sometimes. I had a girl, boys and girls complain the same ways, that they feel left out, that they feel no one likes them, and that really affects their own sense of themselves. So we want to build it up from the inside out. Sometimes with teens, I'll even have them go back to when they were very young and to the little kid that's really hurt and upset, or the first time they felt that way, and have them now kind of comfort that younger child. or they'll mm-hmm. go into a place where I have them imagine their older, wiser, you know, maybe more grown-up person, and what they would say to them, what advice they would give to them.
That's terrific. That's really great, so that they can sort of imagine what they'd be like older and
right.
coming to help them now. It's terrific. Gosh, I wish I knew this when I was a kid. Right?
Me too.
and
we were touching on the tools, and yeah. for me, one of the important tools is connecting with your heart and your gut feelings, because it goes with the old tradition of listen to your heart and, you know, trust your gut feelings. And yet it goes a little further, because now we have research showing that there are cells in our intestinal tract that are similar to some cells in our brain. And then the group HeartMath Institute has done a lot of research showing how the heart has its own wisdom. In fact, there are some anecdotal stories, many, but not, you can't say across the board, but some people that get heart transplants start wanting the same ice cream that they're, mm-hmm. you know, the person that donated the heart liked, or liking something they didn't like before, but the donor heart, the person who had the donor heart liked. So it's very interesting. There might be something going on there. So I'd like to encourage everyone to connect the wisdom that's in your heart, in your belly, with your mind, because your mind is very important, of course. But I think
right.
it's richer response when you connect them all.
Right, and the heart is the first organ that's formed in the uterus. So, I always felt that that was a very powerful thing, that we should, you know, to feel from it and think from it more often than just the thoughts in our head.
Yes, yes. And that's wonderful. I didn't know that fact. That's amazing.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing. And look, kids as young as three, I had a three-year-old say, connect with his belly, and his belly told him to share with the kids at preschool.
Hmm.
So you could do this at very young ages. I mean, originally I thought maybe five would be a good age, but depending on the child's language, you could really teach some of these simple skills. My little three-year-old cousin, barely three, has been listening to some of my CDs to help her fall asleep. And when her little younger brother was fussing, she said, put on Auntie Charlotte. So as soon as they start having language, you could start teaching them. And for younger ones, I might call it the rainbow breath, because they might know what a rainbow is from reading stories or seeing one. And they can imagine a rainbow floating into their belly.
Right. That's what my daughter responded to the best, was rain, because she loves rainbows. And when I mm-hmm. said, we'll try a rainbow breath, I think that's the thing that lit her up.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So that's good, and that's what I want to encourage parents to do. Use your own creativity
mm-hmm.
and see what's right for your child, because everyone's unique and different, and you could use these guidelines as giving you a start and then take off on your own.
Now, when we first started the interview, you mentioned asthma, which surprised me, that you can actually reduce your asthma attacks and the need for medication. So how does that work with an asthmatic or an allergic child?
Well, Ran Ambard has done a lot of research in this area, and you could look him up and get all, you know, write to him and get his papers, and I could send them to you personally, you know, my links. But the idea is you want to imagine your lungs, the bronchii in your lungs, clearing out so that the air is flowing very well. And so you use that same way you would use visualization for any disease. You want to see it healthy and working very well. And then for kids, you might show them, if they haven't seen it, pictures of what lungs look like and all the bronchi in them. And so they could get their own visual for it and imagine themselves breathing well. So you want to create a positive picture for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you practice. Now, for adults, when you're using visualization like that and there's an illness, they recommend really a long time, like 20 minutes, three times a day, like an hour a day to work on something physical. But with kids, it's too hard. So I recommend like 5 or 10 minutes
mm-hmm.
times a day. You know, and work your way up.
And I know divorce is such a big problem these days, and children are really caught in the middle of such an emotional turmoil. So what tools might be useful for them in that situation?
Gosh, I had one girl listening to her Special Place CD for 4 years every single night during her parents' divorce. She needed a respite.
Hmm.
And, of course, this is an area I'm an expert in. That's what I did my research on. So I have to put in that if you're going through a divorce, three things. Don't speak badly about the other parent. Don't yell at each other. And encourage a good relationship with the other parent. Now, that's separate from the visualization, the imagination skills, but I wanted to get that out there because that makes a big difference. And if parents are doing better, the kids will be doing better. So I'll have them use their imagination to just support them and be kind to each other and learn to speak up. And if their heart is hurting, even use color to see what will soothe their heart. Or if it's coming out in stomach aches. One girl was having terrible stomach aches because her parents were about to get divorced but didn't tell her yet, and she was picking up on it. So she actually asked for a color, and she got a swirling rainbow, and that helped calm it down. So whatever the problem that comes up around the divorce, whether it's feeling separate, sometimes if your child is at mom's house, you know, two nights, dad's house two nights, and they're missing the other parent, you could have them imagine the love they feel for their parent on a beam of colored light coming from their heart, sending it to their parent, their other parent's heart, and then the other parent sending love back. And what I do with the kids is practice together, like practice in my office so they can practice at home so they can really feel that tug of love. And so that way they don't feel so separated. They could feel still connected to the parent they're not living with.
That's really beautiful. What about kids who are fighting, you know, the siblings? What are some good techniques, or if you have any stories about successes on that?
Oh, yes. I hear this all the time, and there's a beautiful imagery, you know, in the book about connecting the whole family together. But I had one girl who was just really jealous of her younger brother, and she felt a lot of pressure to be the good big sister, and she felt like locks all over her, holding her down with pressure. And so her animal friend, actually a squirrel, I think I talk about as a monkey in the book, had the key to open all her locks, so released her pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And then she also had mixed feelings about her younger brother. She had feelings of love in her heart, and she had feelings of hate, that she actually called hate, in her toe. And then the following week, it's interesting, the hate turned to sadness. And that made a lot of sense because under the anger was sadness about not getting attention and not being the only child anymore and the big girl. And, you know, so what she did was we tried to imagine her sending love from her heart to her toe where her hateful or sad feelings were. And it got pretty far up till her ankle. But there was a gate that closed off, reaching all the way. So we had to have a conversation with her toe and find out what it needed to open up. And what it needed was more time with her mom, so we negotiated with it that she could have more time by helping her mom with the baby, you know, while mom is changing the baby, so she could build in some time there. And, you know, just that idea that, yeah, I can get some more time, opened the door up, and she was able to send love to those sad and hateful feelings.
That's fantastic.
And it just shifts. Yeah. You don't have to explain it to them sometimes. You don't have to interpret it. It's like they get the story. Like when you read a fairy tale or a fable, the kids get the message.
They do.
The story.
That's true. So we have 1 minute left. I want people to know how they can get hold of your book, The Power of Your Child's Imagination.
Oh, go directly to my website, imageryforkids.com. There are direct links to Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And there's lots of free articles. There's lots of audio samples of guided imageries, you know, CDs they might like as well. Just this, a plethora of information.
Great. And last question, you have just like, what's the best advice for parents to help their kids succeed in life?
Oh, the top 10. First of all, I want to say quickly that anyone who signs up can get the top 10 tips at what kids want and need for parents. But let parents know, trust yourself, believe in yourself, have faith, have patience for your child and yourself, and open your heart.
Great. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Great talking to you.
Great. We've been talking to Charlotte Resnick, the author of The Power of Your Child's Imagination. And I want to thank you so much for listening today. You can listen to past shows on the PRN website or on my website, supernaturalmom.com. Don't forget to tune in Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time to hear a Supernatural Teen Show. And I want to thank Gary Null, the founder of Progressive Radio Network, and thank my producer, Jody Lennon, and my engineer, Frank Popick, and Raina Gilead, who helped me write some of my news stories. I'm Beth Greer, Supernatural Mom. And remember to teach your children well.
That you can live by. so. Become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye.